Welcome. For those of you who don't recognize me, I'm Tony Bernhardt. I'm a friend of Sylvia's, and it is on. Oh, it's right up here at my neck. Maybe I need to talk louder. Last night it was at Folsom Prison, and in the chapel they don't have any air conditioning, so the fans were all, you know. So last night it was like I was talking to an auditorium. There were three people, but. But you couldn't be heard over the fan, so this morning I can. In any case, I show up here occasionally when Sylvia's off watching Grand Opera or partying. And let me just start, because I know that there's at least one announcement, and there may be four, and this is the time when usually we have announcements. So. Go ahead.
Well, I just have to announce that those of you know that there's a feedback that's in the back after the class B, which keeps the lights on here at will. The second is a little basket for the homeless. We provide money so that they might eat a little more heartily. Thirdly, maybe most importantly, is the Donna basket, which because he's really giving us his knowledge in the spirit of the Buddha for 2,500 years. It teaches what we see in Kono's cave, but just your good teachings, really. So we could please consider contributing to that for him. When we're all done today, if you could please put your chairs back over here, and if you could take an extra one for the ones that are taken and put your pillows back over in the corner, that would be much appreciated. Thank you. Oh, I know if there's anyone new, you do not need to contribute to the class. That's a gift from Spirit Box to you and to you.
Cliff.
Hi, I'm Cliff Sarin. I'm a neuroscientist at UC Davis, and maybe some of you have heard me. Get up at Monday night class, or sometimes a while ago, teach with Sylvia. Today, I just want to make a brief appeal for participants in a research project that we're conducting in collaboration with Spirit Off. I'm at the Center for Mind and Brain at UC Davis, and we collaborate with many scientists around the world, running a large project called the Shamatha Project. I'm looking at the biological and psychological effects of 1 month retreats. And so we're in the process now of recruiting comparison participants to the yogis who are sitting a month ago this past spring. And here, actually, because we want a comparison participant, we also have a physiological meditation experience. I'm specifically looking for individuals who have sat at least 2, 5 to 10 days for passing the troops. And we are going to be collecting blood and asking people to fill out some questionnaires twice across a 3-week interval. And for that, participation will be paid $80. And we have enough women over 50, but we don't have enough women under 50, and we don't have enough men. So the reason why I'm here is the chance that I might even one person, because we actually are collecting blood this coming Monday and Tuesday. So in a last ditch attempt to fill some vacant spots. It's never a last ditch, but in terms of tight timing, if there's anyone here who is interested in that level of experience, I have a sign-up sheet and a little flyer, and we will email you a project application, or I can give it to you, and we can evaluate whether it can be part of the project. The meditation is also there anybody interested possibly who meets the criteria? Now you know, well, when I do this even at Monday night class, I get a handful of recruits, and of those handfuls, only a handful come.
Yeah.
So this is a kind of long slog. It's a lot easier when everybody is sitting up at the top of the hill and they just have to walk down the street. This would be taking blood. So if there's anybody you know who might be interested, by the way, I'm really glad to be here.
And I just, as someone who, proof of past lives, I was a social scientist in a past life, to make a pitch for Cliff's project because, and recognize the difficulties it is to do field research. So if you've already thought, nah, just to encourage you to reconsider that, nah. So I'd like to start this morning with a sort of a disclaimer, which is that what I'm going to talk about this morning is definitely not the way the Theravadin tradition would present this material. It's pretty much my own thinking. I've found myself drifting away from the tradition itself because it seems to me to require a kind of a suspension of disbelief, if not an outright acceptance and embracing things that, ideas that can't be experienced in this lifetime. And so I've been exploring on my own, and I wanted to talk about the worldly dharmas. First time I ever filled in for Sylvie was, my gosh, in the late 90s sometime, and I remember presenting some material on the worldly dharmas, and I thought it would be, I don't know, 15 years later, worth revisiting. And so I started with, well, let me just rattle them off really quickly so that you know sort of generally the direction. The worldly dharmas, they're eight of them that occur in four pairs. Usually they're translated as pleasure, pain, gain, loss, praise, blame, and the last one, which is usually presented as fame and disrepute. And I don't know, maybe that was a translation that came at a time when fame only came with repute. But I render as recognition and disregard. I went back to the, I started with the looking at the Pali language that was used in the sutta that describes in the Anguttara Nikaya, and the first of these couplets, pleasure, pain, is a rendering of the Pali words sukha and dukkha. And I thought, well, that's interesting. So I went back to look at the definition of dukkha. What it, you know, we all are familiar with what are referred to as the Four Noble Truths. Or maybe we aren't all, but we've heard about them somewhere. You know, the truth of the truth of suffering, the origin of suffering, the cessation, and the path to the cessation. And so I went back to look at them. I actually am not thrilled with the translation, with the labeling them as noble truths. Because these teachings are scattered throughout the Pali Canon, and only a couple of times are they presented as with the phrase Arya Satya, noble truth, identifying them. And Stephen Batchelor has sort of stopped. He just calls them the four. But I think of them as the four teachings. Really, they're the Buddha's primary teachings. So I went to look up what dukkha, how dukkha is presented, how the Buddha presented dukkha as represented in the first sermon. This is Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. Now this, bhikkhus, monks, is the noble truth of suffering. Birth is suffering, aging is suffering, illness is suffering, death is suffering. Union with what is displeasing is suffering. That means getting what you don't want, pretty much. Separation from what is pleasing is suffering. That's losing what you've got that you like. And not to get what one wants is suffering. Pain, sorrow, lamentation, despair are suffering. In brief, the five aggregates subject to clinging are suffering. And that list it's an interesting list, and I know that people have stumbled over birth, aging, death, those things seem to be existential, and then not getting what you want seems to be somehow different. As I looked at that list, I thought, there is something that's common to all of these items here that isn't usually noticed, and that is that they're all unpleasant. Birth, well, we may not remember, but almost every account, first thing people do when they're born, us too, was to scream and go, no. Mark Twain said once, why do people rejoice at births and mourn at deaths? He said, I guess it's because they're not the parties involved. But birth is suffering, aging. Illness is suffering. Unpleasant. Death can be, I guess. I don't know. Not yet, anyway. Having to bear what you don't like, unpleasant. Losing what you like, unpleasant. Not getting what you want, not pleasant. Pain, sorrow, lamentation, despair, unpleasant. I thought, well, that's interesting. That's just a naked quality of experience, pleasant and unpleasant. It's one of the skandhas. It's sort of hardwired into our body. Vedana, which is the feeling tone, is built in. I thought, that's interesting. Unpleasant experience by itself isn't necessarily suffering. We're taught that pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. It's one of the phrases. I thought, well, it's interesting. But these experiences, they're the objects. These are the kind of experiences themselves, when we look at them, that are labeled as dukkha. Ajahn Jumian talks about how desire works. He said, it's like the moth and the flame. The moth only sees the flame. Everything else is dark. And it flies right into it. Just like the object of our desire. What the moth doesn't see is its own compulsion to fly into the flame. The origin of suffering, the second teaching is that the origin or the condition for dukkha is tanha. Is translated as craving. It's the desiring, wanting things to be not unpleasant. So it's that tanha which converts unpleasant experience. And tanha is not a morally bad thing. I think it's probably encultured in our organism over evolutionary time. Those of our ancestors who preferred pleasant experience to unpleasant experience would probably have had a better chance of surviving to pass on their genes than if you woke up in the morning and said, you know, how can I make myself miserable? And we sort of don't do that. So I think it's a quality of the organism, this tanha. It's a survival thing. One of the kinds of tanha, bhava tanha, is the craving to be, the survival kind of impulse. It's built into the organism. And when this tanha, which we experience as a need, a want, a thirst, actually is a good translation of tanha, when this tanha appears, it transforms unpleasant experience into dukkha. And the third teaching is that the cessation is possible, and actually the cessation in the text is the cessation of tanha, the craving. And the path to the cessation, or actually I think of it as the way of being without suffering, the Eightfold Path, is a... I talked about basketballs last week. You know, it's a basketball. We talk about basketballs in my group in Davis. So the Eightfold Path, it's like an Eightfold Path, and everybody thinks that it's fragmented into eight folds. But a basketball, you know, here's the Eightfold Basketball. It's brown, it's a sphere, it's got little dimples on it, it's made of rubber, it's filled with compressed air, it's about 15 inches across or so, is that about? And it weighs a couple pounds, give or take, is that eight? You know, it's an entity, it's a thing. You can't just play basketball with the brown, you know. But for conceptual purposes, we can distinguish these qualities. And so the Eightfold Path is like that. It's not a one-fold path, it's an eightfold path. And it involves all eight elements. So the first of these worldly dharmas, sukha and dukkha, pleasure and pain, is how they're rendered, or happiness and suffering, dukkha. We're looking at conditions that bat us around. Now they arise and pass, pleasure, pain. They're in us. Ajahn Chah used to say the worldly dharmas are in us. They aren't out in the world. No. And they occur at the different sense gates, but they occur in us. You know, the old question, if a tree falls in the forest and there's nobody there to hear it, does it make a sound? Well, you know, sound occurs in our neurology. Other things are happening out there in the woods. There's whatever we think is happening, but sound occurs in our neurology. If there's no neuro-robotic organism out there to register it, sweet is not particularly in sugar. Sugar is not sweet. Sugar is just a chemical. Sweet occurs in our neurology. The worldly dharmas are in us, tanha, the desire for things. And so we've got these things built in, the preference for pleasant experience at each of the sense doors. So we sort of like physical comfort. Gets too warm, we turn the thermostat down. Pleasant, you know. Waikiki Beach, pleasant, in terms at least of the ambient weather. We like pleasant sound. Nails on a blackboard can be kind of unpleasant. We like, you know, the smell of good cooking or incense. We don't particularly like the smell of restrooms and, you know, pleasant, unpleasant. It's built into the organism. And although we think of pleasant, unpleasant often, mostly, maybe even mostly, in terms of the physical senses, most of our problems are related to the mind. And for the Buddha, the mind was the sixth sense gate. And it shows up as, in the aggregates, as sanya, as perception, as view, as narrative, as story. It's the interpretation that the brain presents to itself of the world, the map. And actually, that's you know, most of our unpleasant experience in the world is there. I like to think, I mean, if you look around, really, we're living in the heaven realms. But we've got the soundtrack from hell, and it makes us miserable. And pleasant and unpleasant views, or I use the term views, but it's stories or opinions, things that are pleasant or unpleasant, they stand by themselves. We get distracted by what they're pointing at. You know, people, there's an old aphorism about Zen is a finger pointing at the moon. But if you mistake the finger for the moon, I have students who I occasionally say to, too many fingers, not enough moon. There's a passage from something by Tanjef. He was a monk who lives in Southern California and has translated huge quantities of the Pali Canon and put it online, so may be familiar with him, but he says a view or an idea or a thought or a story or a narrative, a view is true or false only when one is judging how accurately it refers to something else. If one is regarding it simply as a statement, as an event in and of itself, the question of true and false no longer applies. It's just a statement. And yet, view can be pleasant or unpleasant. Just a thought can be pleasant or unpleasant. Probably the thought of, oh, say, Rush Limbaugh. Global warming, unpleasant. Unpleasant. Edward Snowden, well, different reactions. For some people, pleasant. Some people, unpleasant. It's just a view. And so view, understanding, story, these things, pleasant, unpleasant, they occur in our mind and we get reactive to them. We talked last week, we were talking about the skandhas and sanya and sankara. You know, we basically perceive and we react to our own internal perception. It makes sense, and we get reactive to that, and we notice that, and then we react to that, and we notice that, and we react to that. That's how we spend a lot of our time. As we second guess ourselves, and the unpleasant stuff, you know, Rush Limbaugh, or global warming, or whatever. Unpleasant stuff, we react to the way we react to unpleasant things. How do we react to unpleasant things? Well, you know, there's sometimes just straight out denial, just look somewhere else. We can indulge in comfort food or other kinds of pleasures to sort of cover it up. Sort of where the third precept is aiming, where we can anesthetize ourselves somehow. now, which is where the fifth precept is aiming. Or we can, you know, create a counter irritant. We can get angry. You know, it's like scratching a mosquito bite, which actually, if you pay attention to the scratching, not pleasant. It's unpleasant, but it overwhelms the itch. So, you know, we get an unpleasant thought and we talk back to ourselves often. And I don't like that. You know, we evaluate. But pleasant and unpleasant occur in the mind, in views. We like stories that have happy endings. You can't make a lot of money with a Hollywood movie that doesn't sort of have at least an upbeat ending. People just don't want to go see it more than once. You know, we like our stories pleasant. We like our endings happy. If we like a touch of realism, we like, you know, after 20 minutes of news, we get 3 minutes of a warm fuzzy at the end of the, you know, something to, you know, pleasant and unpleasant. Egypt's not pleasant, but the kid who overcomes. See, you know, the story was it last week of the kid with one arm who's got an NCAA scholarship to Kentucky to play basketball. You know, feels good. You know, we like good stories. We like the happy views. We don't like the unhappy views. Please. Well, I sort of think it's voyeurism. You know, my granddaughter, who's just 12, loves roller coasters. The scarier, the better. But, you know, you're locked in and really not much is probably going to happen, at least that you could think of at age 12. So it's really fun, even though it's scary and she screams and, you know. Well, we're doing there, but for the grace of God, kind of stuff. You know, we wouldn't like it if we were in that crash. Yeah. I'm not really a therapist. That's my guess. It is. Well, take a look at it. Do you find those things attractive yourself? Do you find yourself looking at, or do you find yourself looking away from the crash? Or do you find yourself looking to see just what happened? It's those moments to investigate what's going on. When you find yourself attracted to or having aversion to pleasant and unpleasant, because that's really, it's an opportunity to watch our organism at work. And actually it's helpful too, because when you when you watch, you're not as likely to get sucked up into it, you know. The cessation, the third teaching is, the Buddha says, the unshakable liberation is best. But we can settle for a little shaky one, you know, let's see. Of all the kinds of signless deliverance of mind, the unshakable deliverance of mind is pronounced the best. But we can get by with a little bit of shaking, you know. So And we move towards being unshakable as we learn more. So it's those opportunities are a great time to take a look and just see how Tanha works. And it's really clear in the pleasant, unpleasant stuff. And noticing views as just as views. You know, the Buddha's talk to Bahia. I think I brought this up last week too. It's my favorite of his Dharma talks because it's his shortest. You know, in the seeing only the seeing, in the hearing only the hearing, in the touching and the tasting, in the smelling and in the thinking, in the cognizing, in the knowing, only the knowing. So this first of the worldly dharmas, when the pleasant arises, we fall for it, and when we lose it, we suffer, losing what you know. And the unpleasant, the activity of our organism creates suffering. When you mix the two, unpleasant and our organism, its response, dukkha, which is the word that's used, the Pali word that's used. The second of the worldly dharmas is gain and loss, more and less. And of course, it's more of the pleasant and less of the unpleasant. We prefer the hedonic tone of pleasant, and our efforts are to sort of push things towards the pleasant. You know, even when it's less unpleasant. You know. And this is a great place to when you find yourself wanting more, to study, to watch in yourself the activity of greed and aversion, because they're at play here, and this is their play in the organism, in the wanting of more, you know, more or less. Greed and aversion are available. We want more, have all the good stuff. Think of all the good stuff. More people who share our political opinions. You know, we want more financial resources, probably more money, more time, you know, less constraint on our freedoms, more, I mean, you can think of what you want more of and what you want less of, and we get batted around by these things. You know, the prospect of losing was being separated was, I only have 4 pages here, I just can't find my way. Separation from what is pleasing is unpleasant, is suffering, in that first teaching. So loss, suffering. So the negative sides of these, or the unpleasant sides of these, are dukkha. And these four couplets, the first two we've done through so far, are the most complete articulation of the second foundation of mindfulness that I've found anywhere. Because the second foundation is mindfulness of vedana, of pleasant, unpleasant, of feeling. And in the sutta, the Buddha says, you know, one is mindful of pleasant worldly feeling and unpleasant worldly feeling and pleasant otherworldly feeling and unpleasant otherworldly feeling, and then he goes right on to the third foundation. It's like, you know, 6 lines. First foundation, several pages. Third foundation, fourth foundation, a lot of text, but the second one really short. The worldly dharmas are an articulation of that. So this is a place to cultivate mindfulness, these worldly dharmas, to notice the pleasant the unpleasant, the greed and the wanting more. You know, everybody, you know, the studies where they've interviewed everybody about what income level would make them happy, and they almost everybody thinks, well, about 15%, 20% more would be just fine. Doesn't matter what the level is, just a little bit more. And it's a great place to watch how that's working, and bring mindfulness to these. You know, this is one of the foundations. The third of the elements is praise and blame. Praise and blame, pretty much. Well, we like being praised, and we don't like being blamed. You know, it's interesting because in order for us, being blamed is unpleasant. But being blamed doesn't necessarily light us up. If somebody seriously accused you of being a Nazi, you'd think they're crazy. It wouldn't punch a button. If somebody seriously said you're selfish, you might feel a little bit more, might be more unpleasant. More unpleasant? Might be more unpleasant. So praise and blame are in us. It's not just in the blame, it's in our reaction to it. And praise and blame, interestingly, it's always about judgment. And judgment is kind of obscure. We talk about it a lot in Dharma settings. But to articulate judgment a little bit more, it seems to me that judgment is always rooted in some idea we have, a thought, about how things should be. And then we compare our experience, our perception, with that idea, and judgment shows up. It should be this way, it shouldn't be that way. So there's a clinging to an idea here, a belief. You know, when it comes to ideas, clinging is believing, or believing is clinging. So there's this belief, this clinging to an idea that things should be in a particular way. And of course that obscures our ability to see just what is going on, because we're paying attention to how it's not in accord with how we think it should be. So I was thinking about this idea about how things should be or shouldn't be. And it occurred to me that this is really kind of a formulation of an intention. You know, we sort of think that if the world were configured in a particular way, that there might be less unpleasant experience for us, you know. And so our intention is to try to make the world in that fashion. You know. So there's intent, and we think, don't talk with your mouth full. Well, you know, we do think that it would be, I guess, maybe more pleasant to be eating. So we teach our kids, world, you know, you should not talk with your mouth full. Yeah. Or whatever we think, you know. We shouldn't be hypocrites. We shouldn't. Praise and blame. And that judgment, of course, is in ourselves, because what would be pleasant or unpleasant, what would be good and not good varies from one person to another. Do we want more Ed Snowden's and Bradley Manning's, or do we want fewer? And we'll do some thinking about that and come up with another opinion to which we can cling. Praise and blame. Praise and blame motivate us. I remember the first time I even was aware of it, I was walking at the end of a retreat that Sharon was doing, and you know how you walk by people and you get these snatches of conversation that, you know, it was just a great thing that I heard her say as she was talking to somebody as she walked by, and she said, "My job is not to be swayed by praise or blame." I thought, "Oh, that's interesting." This was pretty early in my practice, and it was praise and blame. Worldly dharmas, they move us around. And the anticipation of blame and the search for praise, for pleasant, and the avoidance of dukkha motivate a large amount of our behavior. Mine, anyway, that I've noticed. So praise and blame. The fourth of the worldly dharmas is translated, is often presented, and you'll hear it presented, as fame and disrepute. And I was not happy with that very early on, because in the current media environment, in the current media environment, you can be famous for being disreputable. And so I went to the Pali Dictionary and looked up the word yasa and ayasa. Ayasa is just not yasa. They put an A in front of it to make it not. And I looked up yasa, and the general sense of the word in the dictionary that I got was just recognition. And the And the opposite would be disregard, being ignored, being... And that's unpleasant. You know, when someone cuts you off on the freeway, that's disregard. Disrespect. Being dis, yeah.
Yeah,
it is. And I think in an interesting way, because this element of the worldly dharmas is about identity. Who are you? Are you even anybody? I could have been a contender. You know, it's who are you? Who, you know, identity view. One of the first of the fetters. One of the first elements to go at stream entry. The recognition of, you know, the fabricated nature of self. But I think this also is built in. You know, as a neurologically animated robot, you know, we have an advantage over other animals because we've got this huge computing, you know, up here, and it functions to make us really efficient survival organisms. And one of the ways that we become efficient at that is to be able to represent, you know, to ourselves through sanya, views, maps, stories, narratives, understandings, you know, to represent to ourselves the way things are, it's to map out abstractly, and to represent ourselves in that mix. We become much more efficient if we can, you know, I'm here and I'm moving around. If I do this, if I do that, then I think it becomes a survival advantage. And those of our ancestors who did that were probably generally over time more likely to. So I think this creation of identity is part of this organism's pattern of behavior, like vedana or like tanha. And it's in the service, of course. But it does obscure what's going on, because we believe the concept. We think they're nouns. Just because they're nouns in language doesn't mean there are any things anywhere. If everything is in process, remember Nietzsche and Anatev, if everything is in process, then there's nothing that's really a thing. All we've got is a snapshot at a given moment. We call it a thing, an entity. But it's all... I seem to be a verb. Yeah. Well, Joanna Macy says, I seem to be an information pass-through, you know. Yeah. But even, you know, there's nothing. You say, this is a pen. But really, that's a... you're seeing colors and shapes. You're thinking pen. You know, it's a noun, but the matter that's in this pen. I love the Zen tradition. They say, call us a pen, I'll hit you with it. Say it's not a pen, I'll hit you with it. You know, which is, I think I said last week, why I'm in the Theravadan tradition. You know. But the matter that the matter that's in here wasn't pen probably even a year or two ago. And God knows that in a few million years it won't be looking pen-like. It will disperse. I tend to hang out on the NASA website, and there's this little video clip that a couple of astrophysicists talking about, they're talking about the creation of heavy elements in exploding stars. And the only place where you get iron in this universe is in a supernova. And you've got it in your blood. And all the iron in the hemoglobin in your blood came from a supernova somewhere. So, you know, things, and there are no things. You know. But identity view, we do think of ourselves as an entity. And we want to be recognized as such, even if it's fabricated, which is why it feels good when people recognize us, to be seen. Well, we do feel more substantial when people are saying, you look great. Or even if they say, you know, you look lousy. You know, however you think you are. You know, are you old, young, smart, dumb, attractive, whatever, however, you know, however you identify who you are. We like to be recognized, and we don't like disregard. Suffering. So the negative, the positive sides of these are not so much of a problem, except that they don't last. You know, so pleasure, gain, praise, and recognition don't last. And the other ones are on the way. And they work together. They interpenetrate. They're sort of a basketball too. You know, they success comes with praise and recognition. Comes with pleasant experience, presumably. You know. So the worldly dharmas motivate us. One of the reasons why they are pointed at as a foundation for mindfulness, because our reactivity to pleasant and unpleasant to Vedana. In the chain of dependent origination, following Vedana comes Tanha, and Upadana comes clinging and grasping and suffering because you can't make it stop. Can't make it stop. It's impermanent. The moving finger writes and having writ moves on. So I think it's a valuable tool to recognize the worldly dharmas as they operate and to study how they work, how we work. And a little bit of a map is helpful, I find, in exploring new territory, because the conceptual map does help. It's not useless. One of my friends was talking about a Tibetan friend of his who was learning English. I can't remember if I just told you this last week. And his friend said, "It's amazing. I didn't realize until I learned English how many emotions I had." Because the map that we use helps us look and see. I did say it was one of the Zen patriarchs who said, you know, if you understand something, all you've got is a concept, and if you don't understand it, you're ignorant. And the concepts help us find our way. So I find the worldly dharma is a helpful tool. The concepts of in being able to recognize pleasant and unpleasant experience in ourselves. How do we know praise is pleasant? Right. We can feel it. It's a direct knowing. It's a direct knowing. And so the worldly dharmas give us a chance to directly experience pleasant and unpleasant and their role in motivating our activity and in our satisfaction, dissatisfaction. Please. Yeah.
This is actually really interesting. There isn't a word in Tibetan for emotion.
Mm-hmm.
Is the tone colloquial, or is it truly experiential differentiation because of the semantic matter?
I'm interpreting it that way, but I don't know, because it's all hearsay. Mm-hmm.
And you look at, say, you know, a window, if you want to change the color of people and better dress, you see about million colors.
Mm-hmm.
When you identify magenta, you now have this kind of categorical perception, which does some kind of violence in the continuity.
It's the same with musical pitches. You know, there's an infinite range of pitches, and we settle on a particular frequency to be A. And then after a while, if you've been making music for a while, you can hear A. You can recognize it. So we do the same with other senses too. Any other comments or questions about this, please?
I'm just thinking of pleasant, unpleasant, getting into the things where I could have that, just knowing that that's what's going on, I don't feel like that. Like, you know, got really sleepy, and I was experiencing that.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right. Well, that's part of the benefit of mindfulness, because if you watch, you can see it happening, and you don't get reactive because you're busy watching. The more intensely you can attend to what's going on, the less reactivity. Or when you even notice the reactivity, you don't need to bite. You know, you don't need to take the bait. You know, pleasant experience, or the prospect of pleasant experience, functions as bait for us. We're hooked. Yeah, a lot of envy. I tend to see fame actually as a composite of recognition and praise, or recognition and blame. So disrepute feels like a composite rather than that, which is why I like to render yasa and ayasa as recognition and disregard rather than fame and disrepute, because the worldly dharmas are a basketball, and in our life we experience them as composites often. Yeah, blame. Shouldn't be that way. Disrepute always involves that negative judgment. You know. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. My granddaughter is 12. And we're buddies, so I know what you're talking about. Some of this, you know, we just don't want other people, we don't want our loved ones to suffer. And some of the lessons, you know, you can't yeah, so you know how to work with it. What I do is to pace her and to just be present for the suffering part too, and have compassion. Don't get so excited. You're going to see Taylor Swift tonight. Don't get so excited. It's because it could be a lousy concert, and the cab might break down, and you might not get there. Or oh, well, I'm not either then. Yeah, I think that's. Well, I think that may have to do with teenage brain. And I'm not the neuroscientist, but I read National Geographic. So there's a lot of chemistry going on, and it may just not be something you can rein in. You know, and then we identify with it. Identification, self, occurs around tanha. Tom Wolfe, in his book, I Am Charlotte Simmons, takes us in. I haven't taken a neuroscience class, but I've walked into one through the eyes of Tom Wolfe at Duke. And the professor was saying, we are like a pebble that's tossed across a room that becomes conscious halfway across the room and says, I want to go that way.
That's so
you know?
Right.
The hormones kick in, and all of a sudden we go, I'm horny. We identify, self arises around tanha. Tanha arises, and then self and the object of desire arise together. And some of that is just, it's just the organism, and we keep them safe as best we can. I don't know what else to say. Absolutely, absolutely, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, there are people who do, because envy kicks in. Should not, you got to control yourself, don't you know, so that it shouldn't be that way. Yeah. Oh. Yeah.
I remember anticipating going to my aunt Michael's house because I had three cousins there.
Mm-hmm.
We would have a class. And I would just, you know, be bouncing and the car just, you know, if you're turning the corner, oh, it's only a block away. Oh my God, we're almost there. Oh wow.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that this is bringing up is that one way to work with it is to you know, get your mudita on. Mm-hmm. Anything else? Well, thank you for your attention. I'll see you in a couple weeks.
Thank you. Is that when Tony is coming?
No, I'm here in a couple weeks. And then she's here on the 18th.